Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world and the changing times and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, April the 11th, 2024. This is episode 3478 of the Survival Podcast. And it is a Thursday. That means it's time for an expert panel Q&A show of the week. And I've got a great lineup for you today. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini will talk a little bit about the new minimum wage law in California. But Chris puts it in a really interesting frame. I've said the same thing, but I've never quite framed it this succinctly. All the minimum wage is the outlawing of jobs. Does that make sense? You are outlawing jobs when you issue a minimum wage. That may not make sense. It will after Chris and Dr. Paul talk about it. I'll have a little addition there. Then we are going to have a segment here from Andy McCann on CrossFit. He's going to talk about CrossFit, the methodology, versus CrossFit, the game. Basically, somebody wrote into Andy and said, I think CrossFit is stupid. Sell me on it. And Andy said, I run a CrossFit gym. And I think CrossFit, probably the way you're talking about it, is also stupid. But let's talk about the methodology versus the game. So Andy will talk about that. Sean Mills, who was just on yesterday, is going to answer a question on a diesel space heater. These are available from Vavor, who I'm now working with. I have a link in the show notes to the heater in question. And I think these are great. And the only reason I haven't requested one yet, I know that most of my audience is North America. It's fixing to be summer. So that's on the long-term list of items for product review. So we'll be talking about those in the future as well. Doc Bones will talk about the new bird flu and the alarmism, and is there anything to worry about? And I will definitely have some additions on this one. Jeff Lawton will talk about, well, if your garden's pretty close to a road, and you know that in the past that cars drove on that were running leaded gasoline, should you be concerned about that or other heavy metals that wash off road base and end up on your land where you're growing food that you're now going to eat and you're trying to eat healthy food, but are you eating leaded tomatoes? Are you eating cadmium-infused peppers? You're probably not, no matter how much went down that road ever. And Jeff will explain exactly why. Eric Hammond will talk about how to find the best bang for the buck in a kind of newer but used 4x4 truck. We're getting a lot of truck questions for Eric lately. And I'm going to talk about gardening. And specifically, this is the question I'll be answering when I get to my segment. How do I recommend supporting tomato plants? Calvin said he's seen various photos on the web of how people support their tomato plants. Some seem overkill, including a lot of time and effort to construct, and some seem to not really be very supportive at all. So I'll talk about it from a few different angles because I know everybody's planting right now, and probably the gold standard for the number one planted thing in American gardens is tomatoes. I can't prove that, but I'm going to bet that almost everybody with a garden, unless they specifically hate tomatoes or are allergic to them, grows tomatoes. I'd say tomatoes, peppers, and cucumbers are probably the plants that the most people grow in gardens, especially summer gardens. And all of them can need or can benefit from some level of trellising or some level of support, because even pepper plants, a lot of people think of them stand alone, but we grow them as annuals in North America, and they grow pretty fast and heavy yields, and you can get plants to fall over, break, have limbs fall off. So it just so happens that the item of the day is part of that answer, but it wasn't planned that way. I was just looking through questions today and thought this would be a good timely one to answer for Calvin. So I'll do that when I get to it. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Well, we're only going to have one sponsor today because I'm welcoming a new sponsor to the fold. And this is kind of a big deal because it just doesn't happen often. Now, the thing is, you have heard of this person and this company and their products before, if you listen to this show regularly anyway. They're already an MSB discount vendor. I'm talking about Anton's Land of Biltong. So I was really stoked when Anton wanted to become a sponsor, and it's been a while coming. both of us have been really busy to get everything set up and ready to go. But he is now a full-time sponsor of the show, not just an MSB discount vendor. Now, I'm going to tell you something about Anton's Biltong. It is addictive. It's addictive. And I'm going to tell you also, as much as I love his Biltong, the sausages he has, like the Dewars and some of the other stuff, like, that's my real fiendish thing. I am doing a hybrid deal. I've never done this before. Anton is paying half of his monthly fee as a sponsor in product and half of it in money. So I'm taking a split on this, and I'm very happy. And honestly, if he'd want to do 100% product, maybe he didn't think I could eat that much. Well, I could. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, I could. If you've always wanted to try Biltong and some of the other really cool things that come from the South African cuisine, you need to check out Anton's Land of Biltong. His banner is on the site now. There'll be a link in today's show notes. And I cannot tell you how addicted to the damn Dewar sausages I am. It's like a sausage with Biltong inside it, and it's got like a little cinnamon thing and a little, like a little bit of a Worcestershire thing. I can't even explain it. But if you've been thinking about picking some stuff up from him, do so. Remember, now he's a sponsor, but he also does a 10% discount. So I put in, even though I get free product, I put an order in today. I got a discount on it. That if I was paying MSB member instead of the owner of the program, you know, it would have paid for 1/5 of my membership for the year on one order. That's a damn good discount. So check him out again, Anton's House of Biltong, Anton's Land of Biltong. You'll see his banner since he's a new sponsor right up at the top of the stack, just under Home Food Systems. With that, let's go ahead and dig on into today's episode. And let's start off by hearing from Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul himself on how the minimum wage is actually the outlawing of jobs. I've never thought of it quite that directly before.
The bottom line of the minimum wage is it outlaws jobs. That's it. That's all it does. And the question is, which jobs are outlawed? Well, in the case of California, anything that could be performed for less than $20. So if a teenager goes in and says, listen, I need my first job, I'll sweep the floors. I don't need $20. I'll do it for $10. You know, I live with my parents. I'm just trying to get some skills. The place has to say, no, it's illegal. It's outlawed. Even though I would pay you $10, I cannot. So by law, you must stay unemployed. Same thing with senior citizens, people that are older. You know, a lot of older people are working these days because the Social Security checks do not go as far as they used to. They could go in, listen, I can't do a lot of things because of my age. I could be a greeter. I could bring, joy into this place by being nice to people. I'll do it for whatever. It doesn't have to be $20. Again, has to be turned down. Illegal. Illegal. Even though both parties agree to the price, that is what the minimum wage does. The higher you raise it, the more people the more outlawed jobs there are. Raise it to $100 an hour. Think of all the unemployment that would create. So we'll talk more about this, but that's the basic gist of it from my point of view.
You know, even in this area, you'd think people would grasp the truth and understand it a little bit better. Without what Chris just said, that makes a lot of sense. But to some people, they say, well, it might make sense, but we have to refute it anyway because we don't want them to get ahead of us. But this whole thing that the businessman will take care of, and that's what they argue. They charge too much for hamburgers. Oh, okay, we raise the wages to $20 to serve a hamburger, and the company starts losing money. What do? Well, if you want the businessman to adjust and stay in business, he has to get rid of half of his crew, or a bunch has to be fired.
That's right, Dr. Paul. Yes, and the minimum wages may shock people, but big business, it's a big blessing for them. Now you might think, no, we're getting them. We're getting the man who's paying us nothing. The government is helping us. They're giving us a raise. No. You know, when it was fight for 15, that disappeared. Now you go into all the fast food places, it's all screens. It's all kiosks. All the people are gone. You know, it was a perfect, way to get rid of the people and put screens, and it's acceptable, So it's much, it's great for big business. It's bad for smaller business. Now the smaller business is under tremendous pressure because he's not a big giant crony corporation. He now has to find a way to survive, and the raising the minimum wage hurts him. And a lot of small businesses won't even be started. No, some will be closed because it's just too much, the minimum wage. And others will be like, I can't start my business. It's just too much to pay for labor. I can't pay everybody $20 an hour. Now, we know from experience and from being around for a while that the goal for these controllers is for it all to be big business. We saw it during COVID. All the policies were, don't go into the small shops because there's COVID. Go with hundreds of people into the big stores. And they're still open. We're going to close all the small shops. So the goal is because they want these big corporations because they're controlled. They all say the same things. They all do all the woke things. BlackRock and Vanguard owns all the share, the majority of the shares of them. BlackRock doesn't own the little guy on the corner, so he can't control him. So this is, and the minimum wage is a way to beat the small businessman again and get him out of the way so it's all big business. You know, but again, that's not how this is sold. This is sold as we're giving you a raise, and it's just another scam.
You know, like I said, I never really thought about phrasing it as the outlawing of jobs. I've made the exact same objections to this that both Dr. Paul and Chris did there, and I have others. But I never referred to it as the outlawing of jobs. But isn't it exactly what it is? You have something you want done. I am willing to do it. I am willing to work for a wage. You are willing to pay the wage. We both agree that it's fair. We're both happy to do it. And the government says we can't do it. That is the outlawing of a job. That's exactly what it is. And one thing people don't understand is people are stupid. That's why they don't understand this. People literally think companies just have money. Like, there is no such thing as companies running out. They all have money. They're all rich. Every company out there is run by some billionaire, even though, you know, they work for the guy and they know the dude, you know, lives in a house not much better than they do, has killed himself to build a small business, let's say a tire shop or a carpentry shop or something, a cabinet shop or whatever. It employs like 10 people, and they think that the guy that runs the place is just rich as shit and he can just afford to pay more money. Well, economic law just doesn't work that way. But here's the bigger thing. It has been so long since we raised the federal minimum wage that you can tell that it's meaningless. I know what California just did, and yes, it is stupid, and I don't care. There's still a shit ton of states that have no individual minimum wage law. They fall under the $7.45 or whatever it is minimum wage at federal level. Do you know what? Do you know how many people in this country work full-time jobs that make minimum wage? Less than 0.75%. Less than 0.75%. So if minimum wage was actually what they say it is, to prevent companies from paying people too little, then that wouldn't be the case. We would have tons of people making minimum wage. Why don't companies pay minimum wage? Because it's so low, most people won't work for it. But who will work for it? Like Chris said, like Dr. Paul said, people that don't need a lot of money that are trying to get some experience, or, you know, older people that don't mind having a little extra money, but they just need something to do. And even those type of jobs are paying $10, $12 an hour today. Markets set wages when markets are left alone. And we shouldn't be outlawing your right to work and my right to employ you at whatever wages we agree to. It's unnecessary, and it is going to be extremely damaging, not just to employment as a whole, but to the youngest generation who is trying to crack into being employed, because they already have their minds warped. I listened to some idiot pinhead-sounding girl with 2 degrees and a certificate on X the other day ranting and raving that the only job opportunity she could get right out of college, even though she had 2 degrees she was very proud of, was like tech support for a call center. You know what I was thinking? Bitch, take the job working tech support for the call center and get some damn experience. So we already have these bucket heads, these empty bucket heads, that think that work is beneath them, and they expect to start out at some managerial layer, you know, for their first job making $100,000 a year. And they don't understand the need to get a foot in the door and start and do something. And this pinhead, by the way, should have been working in something as closely related to her field as possible, at least for her last 2 years of college, while she was getting her 2 degrees and a certificate. Okay? And by the way, there's another one of these people that every statement they make ends like it's a question. If you want to sound like a doorknob, if you want to sound like an absolute idiot, if you want to make sure that any thinking person who has a choice to hire somebody other than you doesn't hire you, end your frickin' statements like a question. There is nothing that makes an otherwise intelligent person sound more like a doorknob than doing that. And she was doing that, right? She needed a start. When we stop allowing low-wage, entry-level positions to exist, because that's what this does, then who really needs those are the 15-year-olds, the 16, the 17, 18-year-old kids, not college graduates, not even in college. They need these opportunities. There's tons of retail opportunities where they can work, I don't know, selling chlorine for pools or something. They can learn how to show up on time and develop a track record. This is destroying that. And it is good for big business. It's good for big business because I can afford it as a big business. You know Walmart's self-imposed minimum wage is over $14 an hour? Walmart. So Walmart has no problem with raising the minimum wage because they know what it does. It helps them take out the mom and pops that they've been taking out for decades. And again, kudos to Chris on framing it that way. It is the outlawing of jobs. That's exactly what it is. With that, let's hear from Andy McCann on CrossFit methodology versus CrossFit the game.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from CrossFit Garage here in Woodstock, Georgia, and I got a question from Joe out in Texas, and he says that basically I just listened to the podcast and I think CrossFit is stupid. Convince me I'm wrong. So that's a great question. CrossFit is stupid. So I am not a fan of CrossFit, the production, the games, the like let's really do crazy stupid stuff. What I am a fan of is CrossFit, the methodology. And I'm not, I mean, I do have a CrossFit gym, but you can only, like I have only the use of getting my word out there to the local Woodstock community because they could actually come to the gym. I'm not paid by CrossFit. I could care less if you do CrossFit. CrossFit can be pretty stupid. People who do CrossFit can be pretty stupid. So at 50, I don't do things like ring, handstand, push-ups. That's just really stupid. So don't do stupid stuff. What I would say is that CrossFit's methodology is for everybody, and anybody can do this. And that's the thing I want to get across. So it's constantly varied, functional movements executed at high intensity sometimes. Okay, so what does that mean to you? Let's take some extremes. If you did Monday walking, and then you did Tuesday walking, and then you did Wednesday walking. Okay, so that's not constantly varied. I just have an issue with that. Doing the same thing every day and expecting different results, I think that's a definition of insanity. You want to mix it up. So constantly varied. So not random. Do things that are varied. Be smart and intentional about it. So let's take that walking. I think the most constantly varied functional movement. The most functional movement you could ever do is walk. I mean, I think one could argue that walking is legitimately the most productive thing in the world because, I mean, pretty much we have to get from here to there, and if you're not in a car or something like that, then you're walking. And so walking or jogging or basically using your 2 feet is the most functional thing. So what I would say is, yeah, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you're going to do something with your feet. Let's vary it, but still use that, okay? So maybe Monday I went for a long walk. Great. Let's call it a three-hour walk. You walked for 3 hours out in the woods. And then Tuesday, you went back to the woods, that same trail, but this time, instead of walking, you jogged it, and you just had a constant jog the whole time. Okay. Then Wednesday, you're back on the exact same trail, so not very much variance, but you're varying what you're doing. So now, every time, you're walking the downhills and the flats, and then you're sprinting the uphills. Okay. They're constantly varied, right? And then the next day, you put on a rucksack, and so now you're hauling around weights. again, your variant. Now, it's still walking as your primary move, but I'm okay with that. I would probably alter it somewhere in there, buy some dumbbells to do something different. But you start to see the point of constantly varying, all right? So intense sometimes. Sometimes I'm just walking. Sometimes I'm sprinting up the hill. Sometimes I put a backpack on, right? So you're able to do these things, and that's what's promoting your fitness is pushing the edges of the boundaries. You don't want to go too far over so that you hurt something, or too far backward so you get no benefit, but you're varying what you do and you're being functional about it. Okay, so the next thing that CrossFit actually adds to it, a gym, a CrossFit gym, not CrossFit the games, CrossFit the methodology, is says there's two ways to help yourself move better with intensity. One is to take notes and track it. So let's say you go on your walk. It takes you, let's say the loop is, I don't know, it's a 3-mile loop. You walk it in 3 hours, whatever. The next time, walk it 1 minute less. If you're doing the hill sprints, or you, let's say you jog it the next day, right? Just jog it a little bit faster, or jog it reverse and jog it faster. I don't know. If you're doing the hill sprints, instead of tracking your time up the hills, because they're all going to be different, maybe say instead of just getting to the top of the hill, I'm going to crest the hill just a little bit. So now you're increasing your sprint time. Or maybe I'm sprinting the flat part that begins the hill. So again, you're increasing it. Track and measure and see what you can do. That's just a little bit more. Don't go crazy. Just a little bit more than what you did before, right? And the next thing that a gym or that environment or the community, like one of the guys on the stream said that he posted it into Noster and got a community of people to back him up and he's losing weight. It's that right there. Community builds adherence, and adherence to attendance, like doing the thing you need to do, is what really drives the needle. The next piece of that is, again, with that attendance, is going to come somebody next to you, right? So if you've got somebody next to you and the guy is going 3, 2, 1, go, you kind of want to go a little bit harder. Now, I'm not saying be stupid with it. I'm saying if you have somebody that's friendly competition beside you, you're probably going to push a little bit more. And so these are the things that I think having that environment, whatever it's going to be, maybe you're doing F3 if you've got that in your area, or that's like, I think it's like faith, friendship, and fellowship. It's a dude thing. You go out and meet with other guys at 5 a.m. and you just do stuff, right? And it's constantly varying. I love it. And it's functional because it's usually just your body, maybe a kettlebell or maybe nothing, right? You're just doing cool things. So it can be anything. It's constantly varied. Functional movements executed at high intensity sometimes. Track and measure what you're doing, and then add somebody beside you to push yourself a little bit, right? So we're looking at, if you're watching the video, you're looking at CrossFit's main page, and you're seeing like older people doing this, and then they're playing pickleball. I mean, that's it. It's just functional stuff. So, guys, it doesn't have to be crazy, and no, I am not paid by CrossFit.com or CrossFit headquarters to talk about this stuff. I could care less what you use. I just found in my life this is a great hack to my fitness. I just turned 50. We're doing the open workouts. That's sort of a competition in CrossFit. Yeah, I know I said don't compete, but sometimes I like to. I like to show people that you can do this and still be healthy and fit. So I scored pretty well on this first workout, and I'm 50. And to me, that's freaking awesome that I can prove to the world that this stuff works, right? So it's the kind of idea, like it's the philosophy of using Jack's survival podcast. It is not about zombies. The name sort of makes you think it's about zombies, but I'm not into survival with zombies or building a bomb shelter. That's not what he does here. His is a lifestyle design, but that as a name sounds kind of like clunky and tough. So the things he talks about still make sense, even if you're not into zombies, right? One is none, two is one, and three is the other thing I can't think of. But guys, do something. You got this. If you have questions, I'm here for you. I'm going to go through the list of questions from that live stream, and I'll be adding those, so Jack will have that for you guys. If you didn't get them answered then, you'll be getting them answered soon. Take care.
You know, I kind of had, I guess, what is an epiphany for me anyway, and there's probably half of the people that hear this are going to go, duh, Jack, you didn't know that. We used to do something very similar to CrossFit a long time ago when no one knew the word CrossFit, and we called it circuit training. We called it circuit training. I'm guessing that really is the predecessor to the modern concept of CrossFit training. You know, I'm not a CrossFitter, but I when I listen to Andy explain that, I think, well, you know, I do kind of follow the CrossFit methodology to a degree, in that I get bored doing the same thing over and over again. So I'll take walks, I'll take runs, I'll take jogs, I'll lift weights, I work out on the heavy bag. Now, the heavy bag is kind of my favorite, but even within that, I'll do high intensity, medium intensity, low intensity, like medium intensity, long rounds, like 3-minute rounds, high intensity, like 1-minute rounds to where you feel like you're going to pass out at the end of 1 minute, like all of those things in that variance. And I think the variance has a great deal of value to human conditioning, because if you condition the same thing the same way every day, there's two problems with that. One, there's a whole lot of other conditioning that never happens. But two is we adapt, and we adapt to a point where we're really not putting in enough effort to get a good training effect anymore. And when I used to go to gyms, I would see this all the time, specifically with women on things like Stairmasters. You'd watch a gal come in, she'd get on that Stairmaster, and she'd do a workout that if you'd never worked a Stairmaster before, it would really, really hit you. But if you did the same workout every day, they barely broke a sweat. And some people will say, well, that means they're very conditioned. Well, they're conditioned up to a point, but what's happened at that point is they're not increasing their conditioning anymore. And it was just you could tell there wasn't a real training effect occurring. So I like the concept there that Andy presented, and if that makes what I do CrossFit methodology, then fine. I don't know that it does, though. Anyway, let's talk about diesel space heaters with Sean Mills.
Hey, everybody, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and I've got a question today from Jeff. Jeff says, what is your assessment of using a 12-volt powered diesel heater for a smaller workspace that only requires 1 or 2 hours of usage per day from late October to mid-April each year? Background, I'm constructing a 20-foot by 20-foot gym on my homestead in Zone 5A, North Central Washington. I'm planning on setting it up using solar since the cost assessment of pulling a line from my breaker panel versus setting up a simple 12-volt system appears to favor the solar side. I've seen 12-volt diesel heaters for camping trailers and vans that might be usable in my situation. Here's a link to the product from Vivor that Jack has recently partnered with, and here's a link to the product on Vivor. Do you have any experience with these systems, and could you weigh in on their application for my situation? Thanks, Jeff. Hey, Jeff. So 20-foot by 20-foot, you're looking at 400 square feet. And one of these diesel heaters, as they are called, Chinese diesel heaters, are basically just knockoffs of a really nice German product that cost about 10 times what the Chinese systems cost. And from what I've been told, everyone that I know that I've utilized these says, hey, the Chinese systems work really well. We did a ton of research when we were building my daughter's schoolie last year, and which is a school bus conversion for the uninitiated. And we actually decided on a diesel heater for her situation because it was very efficient. Obviously, the school bus already has like a 55-gallon diesel tank, so that made it a bit easier. And it's safe, right? So we look at all the different types of motor fuel out there. Diesel is pretty darn safe, particularly compared to gasoline. It's amazing how much more volatile gasoline is. But, this thing is going to put out about 20,000 to maybe even 25,000. I've seen some bigger ones per hour. It's going to sip diesel. It does not use a ton of diesel. Now, the one thing that I've heard a lot from people is that the LCD control, obviously not programmed by a native English speaker, so sometimes both the controls and the manuals that tell you how to utilize the controls are kind of hard to follow, and they go out. So I have heard a lot of overlanders talk about how their LCD control went out. So what we did with my daughter's schoolie, we actually got a switch that's literally just a turn knob. So it's an analog switch. It's kind of on, off, high, low type of deal. And that works great for these systems. So I would say if you're going to be in a situation where you're like, you know, you're going out, you're turning the heater on in the gym, maybe you do a little bit of warm up, then you go out there, you work out for an hour or two, cool off, and then turn the dang thing off. You might consider that knob versus the digital LCD control panel. Also, the link that you sent me and the product review, that's kind of like an all-in-one where the tank and the heater and the control and everything is like all in this nice little box. You might consider just buying those components separately. So buy a bigger diesel tank And, you know, the pump's going to work with it. All you have to do is make the right penetration to the tank. Just a bigger tank, the heater, and like I said, go with the knob control there. And, yeah, it's absolutely going to be sufficient for your application. And I think that this is just a good all-around idea. Like, I've actually thought a lot more about potentially getting one of these and putting it in the house for our in-home use, because diesel is a readily available fuel. There are some videos out there of people kind of running some other alternative fuels through these diesel heaters with varying success. I won't really comment on that because I haven't done any of that myself. But yeah, for a 400 square foot area that's going to have limited use, I think this is the perfect option. Way better than propane, which is going to throw off a lot of water vapor when it's burning and potentially cause some condensation issues for the gym. So there you go. You guys keep getting those questions in the Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
So again, I have a link to the particular heater that they were talking about. And Vivor actually makes quite a few different versions, higher and lower BTU output and things like that. I'm very intrigued by this, and it was one when I started scanning through product and picking stuff out to ask for samples for from my rep over at Vivor. This was like one that instantly like picked my interest up. But the only reason, like I said, that I haven't gone straight to it is that it's like 85 degrees today here, and it's not going to be below freezing for a very long time or cold for a very long time. So I figured this would be something as we head into fall, probably around August, September, would be a good time for me to pick one up and put it through its paces leading into next winter. I think this would be a great product, and it may be quite useful, especially in southern climates where you don't get a lot of super cold nights for greenhouse growers, that especially the people like they plant into their greenhouse early spring, late winter, and the greenhouse itself is enough 90% of the time until you get into the temperate part of the climate. But there's those one or two nights where it's in the low 20s, and inside the greenhouse, if it's not like a thermal mass greenhouse or something, you can have losses. This is my work, you know? So I will be getting one eventually, but if you have call for one now, there's a link in the show notes. Remember, you can get everything at Vivor with an additional 5% off with my discount code. That, along with links for Amazon, all the reviews and everything, is at tspaz.com as always. With that, let's talk about the bird flu with Old Dog Bones. And I got some additions on this one because I smell bullshit again.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award winner in medicine, the fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, also designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Experts are waving the red flag on the bird flu virus as infected wild and food-producing poultry, farm animals like cattle, fur-bearing critters, and recently a dairy worker. The virus, 2020's H5N1 influenza, theoretically has the potential to be the source of the next pandemic. Some claim it could be 100 times worse than COVID. Although the virus is showing up in humans at risk around the world, it's similar to a number of bird flu outbreaks that didn't pan out to be COVID-style societal catastrophes. The math is also a little fuzzy here. Since COVID's total death rate was 1%, a virus 100 times worse would, I guess, kill everybody on Earth. That's not to say that the bird flu is benign. Its death rate could approach Ebola-like figures of 50%. But it hasn't been as easy for the virus to pass on to humans as it has some mammals. Up to this point, the positive results in cattle were the first seen in the U.S. H5N1 was originally identified in geese in China in 1996, but has rarely caused humans to sicken. A case in a Colorado resident in 2022, for example, didn't cause an outbreak. Of course, viruses mutate, and the wrong genetic turn could be reason to worry. As humans exhibit little immunity against the virus once infected, they could be sitting ducks for the bird flu. Sitting ducks, see what I did there? The CDC revealed its genetic sequencing findings for the virus in a technical update on its website. There were minor differences between human specimens and the cattle samples, but both had avian characteristics. One change noted in the viral genome was a known link that helps it adapt to mammalian hosts. This was seen before in past samples, but the good news is it doesn't seem to be related to transmission. Therefore, the CDC states the overall risk to human health remains low at present, and only cattle in Ohio and Idaho have tested positive so far. Herds in Texas, Kansas, and New Mexico, however, are still in the process of being tested. Now, factors that include things like wild bird migrations, especially involving geese and ducks, could worsen the situation. Those that are making trips north and south could spread the bird flu pretty far and wide. Now, just so you know, symptoms of bird flu include eye redness, coughing, body aches, and fevers. The dairy worker recently infected, however, only had eye symptoms and not respiratory, which likely decreases the risk of H5N1 becoming lethal. At present, the CDC doesn't consider the bird flu to be likely. That's great news. Those who are involved in the poultry and other food-producing livestock industry should, however, practice infection prevention strategies like proper and frequent hand hygiene, proper food preparation techniques, avoidance of touching the face, nose, mouth, or eyes when in contact with animals or after using the restroom, and maybe consider influenza vaccination if you're high risk. The above strategies are also useful, by the way, for the general prevention of seasonal influenza. Americans are pretty pandemic-weary at this point, having seen Ebola, Zika, chikungunya, dengue, enterovirus, and COVID in the news just in the last decade. Federal funding for pandemic preparedness is no longer a priority in the U.S. About $335 million for pandemic issues are earmarked this year, well short of the 2025 budget request of $1.15 billion. There is good news, even though it involves vaccines. Two viruses that could form the building blocks manufacturers use to produce a vaccine appear suitable to protect against the H5N1 strain seen in dairy cattle and birds. But right now, most resources are being used to produce standard seasonal flu vaccines. So don't expect the availability of any mass quantity of bird flu vaccine anytime soon. Bottom line, you shouldn't spend nights up worrying about the bird flu, but you should spend some time at the kitchen or bathroom sink washing your hands. Watch out for cold and flu symptoms, and don't answer that ad for a cattle wrangler or a chicken plucker anytime soon, or a chicken wrangler or a cattle plucker. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, don't forget that the Member Support Brigade gets a healthy discount off orders of books, kits, and medical supplies at store.doomandbloom.net. Check out our entire line and get your family medically prepared. You'll be glad you did.
So I am going to worry more about whether or not the candy maker, whichever company it is behind Starburst, comes out with a new flavored candy in the Starburst packages than I am about H5N1 bird flu. That's the God honest truth. I'm not going to worry about it one damn bit, and I don't even eat candy. Okay? As Bones mentioned, they made a huge deal about this one man that was tested positive for this particular flu, which in of itself I already have skepticism on, did he really have it? But all the man had was pink eye. All the man had was pink eye. I think that the media and the government and the NGOs and the big pharma and the giant corporate mega corporations cannot wait for another opportunity like COVID, and I hope they never get one. And I think that's why you get ludicrous, bullshit, nonsensical statements that no one can possibly know stated as though they're fact. It could be 100 times worse. Well, first of all, Bones, I don't mean to correct you, but the death rate from the infection fatality rate for COVID was well under 1%. But let's just say that like that's the number they're using. Okay, I agree with that. So that would be everybody dies. But I don't think it would have to be that. Like 100 times worse could be measured in like economic impacts, which of course the reason we had the bad economic impacts is what? What they did. They caused the economic impacts. So I'm sure they could make the economic impacts 100 times worse if they tried. I will say something else though, and I had to be that blunt so that what I'm going to say next is not taken the wrong way. I said from the very beginning when COVID started, once we got a handle on what we were looking at, which only took a couple weeks for anybody who was actually paying attention, and once I watched the way that they attack things like hydroxychloroquine and said things about hydroxychloroquine that was just untrue. I mean, just any doctor being honest, not afraid, would tell you this claim about it is untrue, that this was all bullshit and it was nothing but a bad cold. And I said, and I got attacked by a lot of you guys when I said it. Okay? But I said something else. The problem with this is boy cried wolf syndrome. So one of the articles I saw about this particular flu, it was like, has crossed over to humans and can now mutate. And my response was, every virus can mutate always. It can now mutate. Well, no shit. Every virus can mutate always. There are trillions of viruses and variants thereof in the world. Your body genetically is more virus than human. This is what you learn when you actually study the issue. However, it doesn't mean that we can't have really bad viral diseases that can be very, very serious. And there is always the potential that it's a bird flu. It could be some flu that's been with us forever that takes some weird mutation that starts taking people out, you know, with a fatality rate of something like 5%. Can you imagine that? An infection fatality rate. Not a hospital, you know, 1% of people hospitalized die. That's not a fatality rate. That's bullshit. Okay? Because that means, well, what about all the people that didn't need to go to the hospital? Right? And we start putting people in the fatality rate of hospitalizations that died of something that wasn't the disease. Like the guy died on a motorcycle, but he tested positive for COVID, so he went down as a COVID death. We started making hospital rates. Like, all this was bullshit. It doesn't mean there can ever be a serious pandemic. And I think one of the big problems with that now would be that we may have one someday, and if it's close enough to the present and enough people remember the recent past, it may not be taken seriously, and it may be worse because of that. Now, the shit they did didn't work, but, you know, I'll just say, it doesn't mean it can never happen, but I'm not worried about it happening. Because you know what else could happen? The sun, we could be off by 4.5 billion years, and tomorrow morning it could start to turn red and grow and swallow the earth into a ball of flames. I'm not going to sit around worrying about that. I could get in my car today to go somewhere with my wife after we're done recording the show, and on the way there I could get hit by a gravel truck, but I'm not going to sit around worrying about that. Like, the whole point of preparedness is to reduce worry, not increase it. But don't think we can never have a real pandemic just because the one we just had was fake as shit. And yes, I'll say it. And anybody that objects to that now, you just don't live in the world of reality. And just because you know somebody who got really sick and or died doesn't change what I just said. Especially people that are immunocompromised and very elderly and have comorbidities. People like that die of respiratory infections all the time. So if anybody's offended, get unoffended. In fact, I will tell you this. Prior to COVID existing, and you can check this. You can fact check this all you want. The primary cause of death listed in people over the age of 80 was cardiac arrest, and the number two, respiratory illness, and then in parentheses, other. Because until COVID, when an old sick person got an upper respiratory infection and passed, we didn't worry about which variety of the flu or cold or RSV it was. That was something we did only for that because, well, we needed the theatrics. Oh, God, I'm back in my COVID soapbox. Let's let that go and move on to something completely different. Jeff Lawton on concerns about lead and heavy metals off of road wash.
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from the Dead Sea Valley in Jordan, pretty close to the Palestine border. Okay, next to a busy road that used to have lead-based petrol. I think you need 17,000 cars a day to get really affected by lead petrol next to a road. But even so, you've got a bit of lead hanging around probably. Look, lead's not a problem without a pH going down to 4.5. At 4.5, heavy metals become water soluble and then the plants take them up. Up until then, plants don't choose to eat lead. Lead is not soluble until you get down to those low pHs. Now, you can get acid rain, which goes to 3.5, and aluminum becomes water soluble and then all plants die, but it has to be more than 20 minutes. So you can get flushes of acid rain, especially with all the industry in America pumping up fossil fuel pollution. you can get flushes and you get a little bit of lead solubility every now and again. But if you have organic gardening techniques where you've got compost with lots of organic matter in the soil because of regular compost, organic matter as mulch and cover crop, your soils are buffered and they won't dip to those low pHs and the residual lead is not a problem. It just can't be taken up by plants as solid material. It has to be soluble, and solubility is going to happen at pH 4.5, and that isn't going to happen in your garden if you're using organic techniques with lots of organic material, organic matter additions. You can talk carbon if you want, but it's not really carbon we're talking about. It's partly carbon or mostly carbon, but the carbon comes with additions of organic matter, and that's a little bit more diverse. So mulches, cover crops, and of course lots of compost, and you're completely buffered. Don't worry about it, you'll be fine.
Yeah, you know, this was one of those things that when I first started kind of a relationship with Jeff, where I had him on the show a few times and actually able to have conversations with him behind the scenes and stuff like that, that I kind of called him on because he was such a fan back in the day. And I'm sure he would still do it, but I think it's a little harder to do now to even get the material because so few people read newspapers anymore. I just don't think it's as easy to come by. But he was a big fan of, in like Zone 1 Garden, Zone 2 Gardening, doing huge, thick newspaper mulch. And, you know, today most of the inks are soy-based, but at the time there's some heavy metals in some of those inks, little bits of cadmium. And it's not a tremendous amount, but it was there. And one of his students was working with us here at Nine Mile Farm very early on at some of our workshops, and I asked him about it. And he said, well, Jeff says it's fine. And Jack Spirko doesn't work that way. Okay, with Jeff, I almost worked that way. Bill Mollison, I got tired of fact-checking Bill Mollison and finding out he was right, and I just completely gave up. But at the time, I was like, no, I got to find it. So when I started talking to Jeff, I called him on this, and he told me exactly what he just said. Like, your plants are not going to eat cadmium, but if the pH gets low enough, they may have to drink it. And the thing is, guys, if you have a 4.5 pH in your garden, you have other problems. And then the biological activity is also the thing. And I want you to think about it this way. The biological means by which plants are able to acquire nutrient and micronutrient is kind of an on-demand. Like, they have to expend energy, so they don't do it unless they want it. And this is true of things they do want and don't want as far as being locked up. So the exact thing that will lock up a cadmium or a lead where the plant just isn't going to end up consuming it, which is biology, is what unlocks things like phosphorus. The average farm field in America today has 40 to 400. I use the term 40 all the time because it's a low number. 40 to 400 years of insoluble, locked up phosphorus in that field. And if we turn on the biology, most farms could go decades without ever buying another ounce of it. At the same time, that same biology renders inert the things that the plants don't want, like salts and metals. Just a thought. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and move on. And now, let us hear from Eric Hammond on finding the best bang for a 4x truck. And I like the way he did this. He gives an answer. Like, this is what I would buy. And then gives, well, even if you don't buy that, here's how to think about it. So it's more general for everybody instead of just the person that asks a question.
Greetings. Eric Hammond here, back with another Expert Council segment with a question from Ben in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that says, what's the best bang for the buck when looking for a used four-wheel drive truck? He has some details here. I want to balance the needs of a homestead work truck and hauling a family of four. Hauling firewood, fencing, IBC totes and animals, full-size truck but could be smaller, no huge towing requirements, but I do want to get a 5x8 trailer. What is the best make, model, year, mileage, and packages for a truck? And I have a budget of $17,000 to $19,000 on the top end. So I've thought about this question for a week, just trying to figure out how I'm going to answer it. And I've got a short answer and a long answer. Short answer, get like a 2016 F-150 with a 5-liter and a 6-speed, and you are golden. We service a fleet here that has over 100 of these trucks from 2012 all the way to, you know, 2023. And you really just don't see that many problems out of them. They are the number one selling truck for a reason. But the long answer to this question is I don't think that a brand or model really matters for a couple of reasons. A lot of these companies, Ford and GM in particular, they have worked together to build transmissions for a long time. So even back in 08, we were building transmissions together. The new 10 speeds, we've built them together. The Ford F-150 transmission that says made by Ford in the USA, you could go down and get seals for that at the BMW store. So, you know, all of this stuff is kind of mixed and matched, and, you know, you're down to just picking a truck that has the best options that fit your needs. And it's going to work out awesome for you. It doesn't really matter what brand. I would prefer anything in the big three, so Ford, GM, or Dodge, and a Toyota. I wouldn't look into Nissans or any other trucks like that. So I got to thinking, you know, what does matter to me the most when I'm looking for a used vehicle? So I bought a lot of them. So if I'm going to put a list of stuff I want to look for, what would I look for? My number one, I know you're in Pennsylvania, no northern climate vehicles, period. I will not buy a vehicle that has been operated in the northern United States. Rust equals death. That stuff gets on fuel lines, brake lines, bolts, fasteners, exhaust. It's awful. I would drive a long ways to get a vehicle that was not from a northern climate. Even if you're going to be in Pennsylvania, if you drove south to get something that was rust-free and brought it back, the lifespan of that vehicle is going to be significantly longer. And there are some treatments that you can do to those vehicles to make the rust not kill them as quickly. Number two, I will not buy an auction vehicle or a former rental vehicle. If you want to look for a vehicle, look for local trade-ins at a dealership or somebody selling a vehicle that would be, you know, a private sale. Your dealership lots get empty. They go to these auction houses. They buy these auction vehicles. And just like a livestock auction, everything there is a cull. People don't want them for a reason, and they're trying to get rid of them. So when these dealers build inventory from auctions, it is not high-quality vehicles. You don't want that. I'm looking for a clean title on my vehicles, and I want to make sure I got lien releases for that vehicle. That is something that is a no-go. If I don't have a clean title and a good lien release, that's not going to work out. I want to look for a clean body on that vehicle. If it's got a good clean body on it, generally it's been cared for most likely. And then lastly, have a mechanic, like an independent mechanic, look it over for a pre-purchase inspection and use that to negotiate a better deal on something. So it'll cost you a few $100, but if you're serious about purchasing this vehicle, just have a mechanic look it over. Nobody's going to have a problem with that unless they're trying to do something shady. But if it needs tires soon, needs brakes soon, has a leaking shock or whatever, you can use that to your advantage to negotiate the price on it. And I think those are the tips that I would highly recommend for looking for a used vehicle. I want to go back to this 5x8 trailer that you mentioned. You said you wanted a 5x8 trailer for around the farm. Think about using that, and maybe you don't even need a truck. You can use a 5x8 trailer behind a car for almost all of your truck needs. You get a couple cattle panels, that thing is suddenly a livestock trailer. If you want to haul lumber back and forth, you want to go get a washing machine, anything you think you could use a truck for, you can use a 5x8 trailer for. I have been known to take a 5x8 trailer behind my truck to go get stuff. I don't want to put a washing machine or a refrigerator in the back of an F-250 when I have a 5x8 trailer with a ramp that folds down and I can just roll it up on it. So you might not even need a truck. Think about what you need a truck for. Think about the options you want. And stick to your guns and buy something that's going to work out good for you. I hope that answer helps you narrow it down. If you got any other mechanical questions, just shoot them my way. Anything gas, diesel, electric, two-stroke, four-stroke, anything that's broke, that's interesting, that needs to work but it doesn't, send it my way. Thanks.
I think that's great advice. And I do think that one of the things the F-150 has going for it is just this massive availability of parts. And qualified technicians if you need service work beyond what you can do. But the other side of it, like, when you really got through all that, he's like, you know, Ford, Chevy, Dodge, Toyota. And then he said, I wouldn't, you know, look at, like, the Nissans of the world and stuff. And as you're moving into four-wheel drive, I probably wouldn't either. Not that they're not decent vehicles, just that you're going to get a better bang for the buck, in my opinion, on a used F-150 than, like, a Nissan Titan. I just really agree with that. And I think the one thing to take away from this, though, is there is a lot of shit talk. There's a lot of haters in every niche, but especially in automotive. I remember I had a video one time with our old Dodge Ram 1500. We had a transmission problem. It was a little part. It ended up being like a couple hundred bucks to fix, but the truck was dead, and we ended up having to walk about 3 miles back to our place in Arkansas and have it towed down and fixed when we were stuck there over the weekend. And I had people in the comments, a little video we did about it, going, Dodge just sucks. I've had four of them and they all blew up. No, you didn't. You didn't buy three that blew up and be like, I'll buy one more. You bullshitter. There's so much bullshit in this space. And what this conjures for me is the words of a guy named Ed Wallace, who if you're not from Dallas-Fort Worth, I don't think he's syndicated anywhere. You probably have never heard of him. And even if you're from here, if you don't listen to the radio occasionally on weekends, on AM, you probably never heard of him. I guess he was on one of the news stations for quite a while, too, though. Anyway, he had a show called Wheels. He'd be like, this is Ed Wallace with Wheels. And he also did this thing called Backside of History, which I really wish he would have turned into a podcast, just those segments, because they're so amazing. I learned a lot from the guy. But whenever somebody would call in, and it ain't just trucks, there'd be all different vehicle brands that they would ask. I'm looking for A, B, or C in brand in a crossover SUV, or a pickup truck, or a four-door sedan, or a sports car. You know what he'd say when they were like, but I heard this one's bad, or how many of them do you see on the side of the road? And the point it was also when people say they don't make them like they used to. And in some ways I agree, because the one thing about older vehicles were they were very easy to work on, especially if you go all the way back to the 60s. You know, I remember some 60s vehicles that I got to work on as a kid. Like, I felt like I could crawl in under the hood, fit anywhere I want. There was like eight things in total under the hood. There's only so many things that can go wrong. You get to every bolt. I get the work on part, but his point was, if you think back, if you're old enough, you think back to the 70s and 80s, you saw a lot of cars on the side of the road that weren't in an accident on a regular basis broke down. And we just don't see a lot of that in vehicles that are 20 years old or newer anymore. And so I am not a big fan of shying away from any brand just because of some bullshit that people say. You know, really. My F-350 Ford, you know, it's a 6-point blow. I drove the shit out of that truck for what I paid for it. I mean, the ever-loving shit out of that truck. And I had one problem with it one time when my dumbass intern put gasoline in a freaking diesel truck. Nobody's going to stand up to that. So just don't over-worry about this stuff. With that, let's go ahead and get into my question today, which again is about tying up tomatoes. And it just so happens that my item of the day today is this Vivor mule tape. and it is totally overkill for everything that I'm about to say, but I'll just mention it because what I love about the mule tape, and I put out a video about it today, is how soft and supple it is, and it doesn't cut into vines and branches and things like that, like thinner stuff can, because it's soft and it's wide. And I'll say right now before I even begin, when you're talking about tomatoes and peppers and things that you're staking up and you're tying to a stake, there is a right way and a wrong way to do it. The wrong way is you take the piece of material and you tie the vine to the stick directly. That is wrong. My grandfather would slap my hand if I got lazy when I used to stake up tomatoes for him if I did that. And his go-to for this was old T-shirts torn into long, basically ties. Because it's the same thing. It's soft. It stretches a little bit. So no matter what you're going to do, if you're going to tie a tomato, which is even a big, thick trunk, stalk, is pretty easy to bend break, this is what you do. Whatever you're using, whether it's mule tape, whether it's a torn T-shirt, no matter what it is, tie it to the static point first. The stake, the trellis, whatever. Make a knot tied to there. Then come around your vine and tie it up to it so that there's a knot on the outside and the inside of the vine. And do not cinch it down. Leave some space in there so it's got, you know, a quarter inch or a half inch of space. Like, so you can stick your little fingertip inside the loop and let the loop hold it. And that gives room for the branch to grow. It gives room for, if there's wind, for it to shift. So you're less likely to get, you know, a crimp or a kink in a vine, which can cause a lot of problems. That's why we crimp kill cover crops. So that's step one. Then is to decide what you're doing and what works for you. And this is a context issue. And I'm trying to more and more teach context in everything that I do. And for those of you who are long-term members of the show, you know that one of my favorite answers is, it depends. And as I've started framing things with context, I realize it's another way of saying it depends. And here's what I mean. So I will grow about 10 tomato plants every year. And so the question was, how do I do it? So this is that answer, but it may not be how you should do it. My backside of my garden, so that I'm not shading out my other crops, I have, again, 48 linear feet of cattle panel. And those cattle panels are held up, you know, each side is held up with three landscape timbers, but one's at a corner, so each bed has five landscape timbers. So I plant a tomato right next to all 10 of those landscape timbers, and mostly I just train those tomatoes up those timbers. That is totally overkill. A much smaller stake would work, but they're there, so I use them, and that leaves the majority of my trellis open for squash and beans and other vines, like cucumber. And then I also take in between my beds, and I have them, they're 6 foot wide, and I have an arch that's about 6 foot six high in the center, made by taking a 16-foot cattle panel and making an arch. And most of that is going to be cucumber, squash, but sometimes I train tomatoes up those as well, and I just kind of weave them in and out of the cattle panel. All right, this kind of thinking is fine for the gardener, which is probably who this person is. It's probably a gardener, yeah? Let me tell you what my grandfather had me do. Every year, I would go out with a machete or a hatchet, and I would go into the woods around the house, and I would look for saplings, and he would say that would make a good bait casting rod. So 8 to 9 foot, nice thick base, tapering up, and I would cut those, and I had to bring 18 back, because my grandfather, like clockwork, grew 18 of his tomato plants. And I would put those 8-foot stakes about a foot into the ground, so you get about 7 foot, and I would do exactly what I said. I'd tie the main leader of the tomato by tying first to the stick and then to the plant, and train that up. And when the suckers came out, he would tell me to prune the suckers off. Now, like a lot of gardeners, he and I still don't really do something called hard pruning. In other words, there's one main, but you let some of the other side shoots come up with it, and you tie them. But if you let too much of that goes on, the plant becomes too unwieldy, and it will actually yield less than if you are tight on your pruning and keep pruning enough to allow airflow through. So that's one way to do it. Any kind of a stake, any kind of a trellis, tie to the hard side first, and then tie a loop around your vine, and then prune your tomatoes into a manageable form. Now, but what if you're doing a market garden, and you have 100 tomato plants to deal with? You probably don't want to do any of the things I just said. The best thing to do then is to put in a trellis that looks an awful lot like a grape trellis, except the wire, the top wire anyway, is pretty damn high, 6, 7, 8 foot even. And then probably one more wire a little bit low down, and if it's a real tall one, maybe you have 3 wires like a grape trellis. And then to tie your tomatoes or run vertical wires down off the top, that's another way to do it, space your plants according to your needs, and you do the same thing, tie off to those wires. However, at that volume, perfection is less important than efficiency, so a lot of people doing that will use I think they're called tie guns or a plant tie gun, and basically they use that rubbery, tape-like tie, and you can push them and click, and it's almost like using a stapling gun, and it just puts those ties on, and then there's other forms to do that. That may be what you mean by it seems like a lot of effort and a lot of money and a lot of time and it's not worth it. And if you're growing 8, 10 tomato plants, it probably isn't. If you're growing dozens of them and you are in a market farm scenario and you want to keep continuous production going, that accompanied with hard pruning, running indeterminate plants. So that means that tomato will just keep growing, that vine will grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. Until the cold kills it. It will just keep getting longer and longer and longer. And what will happen is it will actually stop producing closer to the root and want a fruit with the newest growth. And so what I've seen hard pruning operations do like this is create that trellis or that strand drop environment. And they'll train that one main vine up. And I can't explain hard pruning on the show. You want to look up on YouTube and find somebody doing it that knows what they're doing. And what they'll do a lot of times is when that vine reaches the top of that trellis, they'll actually start training it back down and they'll aggressively prune off the vine that came up starting at the bottom, even tighter than the hard pruning. There's very little left of it. And now that one that's coming back down, and I've seen it go up and down 2 or 3 times in a season like that. And some of these folks doing really intensive, you know, foliar treatments and stuff, that are growing like cherry tomato species like this, they're able to produce massive yields by taking that approach. I'll tell you what I don't like. Tomato cages. Tomato cages to me are useless. They're generally about 3 foot tall, and when you stick them in the ground, they're 2, 2.5 foot tall. And that tomato is up and out of that damn thing, you know, before it's even really fruiting much. So those pushing the ground tomato cages, I have no use for them. And so hopefully that'll help, you know, you figure out a method that will work best for you. But the biggest problem people have with tomatoes, in my opinion, is they do not prune enough. And even if you're not going to full-on hard prune, the more you let that thing turn into a bush versus a controlled vine, the harder it is to maintain it and to keep airflow, and the more disease issues you're probably going to have. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Again, thank you for tuning in today. Again, my item of the day is the Vivor mule tape. I'm not going to say any more about that. There's a link in today's show notes for you if you want to check it out. But I also have another thing to remind you about. Let me check real quick before I say this and make sure it's still available. And indeed it is. As of Thursday, April 11th at 1300 hours, the Anker Power Bank 26,800 milliamp external battery is still available. It's at 36% off. Like I said yesterday, it's about $42. I have had this thing on a price watch for 5 years, and I can see a graph and the tool that I use that shows me it has never been this cheap. Anker doesn't do discounts this big usually on something like this. This product, when it originally came out, retailed around $80. Over time, it came down to about a $65 product where the retail is now. But now you got a 36% on top of the already declined price. My instinct, and I'm right about this about 9 times out of 10, is Anchor is discontinuing this product. And whatever they replace it with is going to be significantly more expensive and maybe a little bit better, but not that much better. This is the beast. This is the tank. This is something that will charge a freaking, you know, a MacBook Air twice, let alone what it'll do for an iPhone or an Android or something like that. 6, 7, 8 charges, depending on the device you have, from zero. It's about the size of 2 old school laptop batteries put together. It is a hoss. It works. It has longevity. Mine's over 4 years old. In fact, I'm looking, it's not quite 4 years old. The newest one I have, I purchased on September 24th, 2020. I have the page up right now to check on it. It still works as good as the day that I got it. If you have any needs for backup power for your devices, I would get this one or two of them now, because I'm not guaranteeing you when the steel goes away, the product will be gone. But my gut is it shall be. With that, you can always make sure you don't miss opportunities like that by being on the Telegram channel. Consider becoming a member. Thank you, my friends. And tomorrow I will catch you with, of course, a Friday flashback.
Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.